again, that her rage might dissolve, if she let it, into tears which would wash it all away, leaving her weak as any girl. Abruptly she thrust the door back and entered without ceremony. Taliesin, the Merlin, was there, but he wasn't playing. His hands were clasped attentively in his lap as he bent forward, listening. Vivian, too, in her simple house robes, was seated, not in her accustomed seat, but further from the fire. She had given the seat of honour to the strange harper. He was a young man, in the green robe of a bard, smooth-shaven in the Roman fashion, his curling hair darker than rusted iron. His eyes were deep-set under a forehead which seemed almost too big for him. And though Morgaine, for some reason, had expected them to be dark, they were instead an unexpected piercing blue. He frowned at the interruption, his hands stopping in the middle of a chord. Vivian, too, looked displeased, but ignored the discourtesy.
"Come here, Morgaine, and sit by me. I know you are fond of music, and I thought you would like to hear Kevin the Bard."
"I was listening outside." The Merlin smiled.
"Come and listen, then. He is new to Avalon, but I think perhaps he may have much to teach us."
Morgaine went and sat on the little seat beside Vivian. The Lady of the Lake said,
"My kinswoman Morgaine, sir, she too is of the royal line of Avalon. You see before you, Kevin, she who will be lady here in years to come."
Morgaine made a startled movement. Never before had she known that this was what Vivian planned for her. But anger drowned out her rush of gratification. "She thinks she can say a kind or flattering word, and I will rush to lick her feet like a bitch puppy."
"May that day be far distant, Lady of Avalon, and may your wisdom long continue to guide us," said Kevin smoothly.
He spoke their language as if he had learned it well. She could just tell that it wasn't his own. A little hesitation and thought before the words, although the accent was almost flawless. Well, he had a musician's ear, after all. He was, Morgaine surmised, about 30, perhaps a little more. But she didn't look too closely at him after that first quick surprise at the blueness of his eyes. Her gaze was bent on the great harp at his knee. As she had guessed, it was somewhat larger than even the harp Taliesin played at the great festivals. It was made of a dark reddish gleaming wood, completely unlike the pale willow wood from which the harps of Avalon were fashioned. And she wondered if it was this which had given it the silken brilliant tone. The bowed edge curved in a line as graceful as a cloud. The pegs were carved of a curious pale bone, and it was painted and adorned with runic letters strange to Morgaine, who had learned, like any educated woman, to read and write in Greek characters. Kevin followed her close scrutiny, and looked somewhat less displeased as he said,
"You are admiring my lady."
He ran his hands caressingly over the dark wood.
"I named her so when she was built for me. She was the gift of a king. She is the only woman, whether maiden or matron, whose caresses never weary me, and of whose voice I never tire."
Vivian smiled at the harper.
"Few men can boast of so loyal a mistress."
His smile was a cynical twist.
"Oh, like all women, she will respond to whatever hand caresses her. But I think she knows that I can best make her thrill to my touch. And being, like all women, lecherous, I'm sure she loves me best."
Vivian said,
"It sounds to me as if you had no good opinion of women who are flesh and blood." "Why, so I have not, lady, save for the goddess."
He spoke the words with a faint lilt, not quite mockery.
"I am content to have no mistress but my lady here, who never chides me if I neglect her, but is always the same sweet paramour."
"Perhaps," said Morgaine, raising her eyes, "you treat her rather better than you treat a woman of flesh and blood, and she rewards you as is your due." Vivian frowned, and Morgaine knew she had trespassed by this bold speech.
Kevin raised his head suddenly from the harp and met Morgaine's eyes. For a moment he held her gaze, and she was astonished at his bitter hostility, and with it the sense that he understood something of her rage, had known his own, and fought through it. He might have spoken, but Taliesin nodded to him, and he bent his face again over the harp. Now she noticed that he played it differently from most harpers, who held their small instruments across their body, playing with a left hand. He set his harp between his knees and leaned forward to it. It startled her, but as the music began to fill the room, like moonlight rippling from the strings, she forgot the strangeness of it, saw his face change and grow quiet and distant, without the mockery of his words. She decided that she liked him better when he played than when he spoke. There was no other sound in the room, only the harping that filled it to the rafters, as if the listeners had stilled even their breathing. The sound swept away all else, and Morgaine dropped her veil over her face and let the tears come. It seemed that in the music she could hear the flooding of the spring tides, the sweet awareness that had filled her body as she lay that night in the moonlight, awaiting the coming of the dawn. Vivian reached out to her, and, as she had done when Morgaine was only a child, took her hand, gently stroking her fingers one after another. Morgaine could not stop her tears. She raised Vivian's hand to her lips and kissed it. She thought with a crushing sense of loss, "Why, she is old. She has grown old since I came here." Always before this, Vivian had seemed to her ageless, unchanging, like the very goddess herself. "Ah, but I too have changed. I am no longer a child. Once she told me, when I came here, that a day would come when I would hate her as much as I loved her, and I could not believe it then." She struggled against her weeping, afraid she would make some sound which would betray her, and even more, interrupt the flood of music. She thought, "No, I cannot hate Vivian." And all her rage melted into sorrow so great that for a moment she thought she would break into the fiercest weeping. For herself, for the changes in herself, for Vivian, who had been so beautiful, the very face of the goddess, and who was now nearer to the death crone, and for the knowledge that she too, like Vivian, with the relentless years, would one day herself come to stand as the crone. For the day she had climbed the Tor with Lancelot, and lain there in the sun, hungering for his touch, without clearly knowing what it was she wanted. And for something which had gone from her, irrevocably. Not virginity alone, but a trust and belief she would never know again. And Morgaine knew that beside her, Vivian too was weeping silently behind her veil. She glanced up. Kevin was motionless, only his fingers alive on the strings. Then the sighing madness of the music shivered into silence. He raised his head, and his fingers swept the strings, plucking them gaily to a merry tune, one sung by the barley sowers in the fields, with a dancing rhythm and words that were far from decorous. This time he sang. His voice was strong and clear, and Morgaine, under cover of the dancing music, sat up and began to watch his hands, pushing her veil aside and contriving to wipe away the betraying tears as she did so. Then she noticed that for all their skill, there was something strangely amiss with his hands. They seemed somehow misshapen, and studying them, she noted that one or two of the fingers lacked a second joint, so that he played deftly with the stubs, and that the little finger was missing entirely from his left hand. And all along the hands, beautiful and supple as they seemed when he moved them, were odd discolorations. As he set down the harp, leaning to steady it, his sleeve fell away from his wrist,
and she could see hideous white patches there, like the scars of burns or some ghastly mutilating wounds. Now that she looked on him closely, she could see that his face had a fine network of scars along chin and jawline.
He saw her staring, and raised his head, meeting her eyes again, and holding them with a hard, angry stare. Morgaine looked away, flushing. After the music which had searched her very soul, she would not have wounded his feelings.
"Well," Kevin said abruptly, "my lady and I are always glad to sing to those who love her voice. But I do not suppose you called me here entirely to entertain you, madam, nor you, my Lord Merlin."
"Not entirely," said Vivian, in her rich, low voice, "but you have given us a delight I shall remember for many years."
"And I," Morgaine said. She felt as shy now before him as she had been bold before. Nevertheless, she went forward to look more closely at the great harp and said, "I have never seen one made after this fashion."
"That I can well believe," Kevin said, "for I had it made after my own design. The harper who taught me my craft threw up his hands in horror as if I had blasphemed his gods, and swore it would make an unholy clamour fit only to frighten away enemies. Like the great war harps, twice as tall as a man, that were dragged on carts up the hills in Gaul, and left there in the wind to make ghostly noises, so that they say even the legions of Rome were frightened. Well, I played one of those war harps, and a grateful king gave me leave to have a harp made exactly as I chose."
Taliesin broke in.
"He speaks the truth," he said to Vivian, "though I did not believe it when I heard it first. What man and mortal could play one of those monsters?"
"I did it," Kevin said, "and so the king had my lady made for me. I have a smaller one to the same design, but not so fine."
"Indeed it is beautiful," Morgaine said. "What are the pegs? Are they seal bone?" He shook his head.
"They are carved, so I'm told, from the teeth of a great beast that lives in the warm countries far to the south," he said. "I only know that the material is fine and smooth, yet hard and durable. It's more costly than gold, though less gaudy."
"You do not hold it as I have ever seen a harp played."
"No,"
Kevin said, with his twisted smile.
"I have but small strength in my arms, and I had to experiment to find how I could best do so. I saw you look at my hands. When I was 6 years old, the house where I lived was burned over my head by the Saxons, and I was pulled out too late. No one thought I would live, but I surprised them all, and since I could neither walk nor fight, they set me in a corner and decided that with my broken hands..."
He spread them out quite dispassionately before him.
"Perhaps I could learn to spin and weave among the women. But I showed small disposition for that. And so one day an old harper came by, and in return for a bowl of soup, set himself to amuse a cripple. When he showed me the strings, I tried to play, and I did make music, after a fashion. So he got his bread that winter and the next by schooling me to play and sing, and said he could put me in the way of earning a livelihood with my music. And so for 10 years I did nothing but sit in the corner and play, until my legs at length grew strong enough that I could learn to walk again." He shrugged, and pulled a length of cloth from behind him, wrapping up the harp in it, and sliding it into a leather case embroidered with signs. "And then I became harper to a village, and at length to a king. When the old king died, his son had no ear for music, and I thought it best to get well out of the kingdom before he began to look covetously at the gold on my harp. Then I came to the Druid Isle, and there I studied bardcraft, and at last I was sent to Avalon. And here I find myself," he added,
with a final shrug. "But still, you have not told me why you bade me attend you, Lord Merlin, nor these ladies."
"Because," said the Merlin, "I am old, and the events we set in motion this night may not come into their full flower for another generation. And when that time comes, I shall be gone."
Vivian leaned forward and said, "Have you had warning, father?"
"No, no, my dear. I would not waste the sight on such a matter. We do not consult the gods to tell if the next winter will bring snowfalls. And as you brought Morgaine here, so I brought Kevin the Bard, so that there may be one younger than myself to follow what may happen when I am gone. So hear my news. Uther Pendragon lies dying at Carleon, and where the lion falls, there the kites will gather. And we have had word brought to us that there is a great army massing in the Kentish countries, where the treaty people have decided that now is the moment to rise and take the rest of Britain from us. They have sent for mercenaries from the mainland, north of Gaul, to join them in overthrowing our people and undoing what Uther has done. And this is the time for all our people to fight behind the banner we have worked so many years to raise. There isn't much time. They must have their king, and have him now. There is not another moon to waste, or they will be upon us. Lot wants the throne, but the Southmen will not follow him. There are others. Duke Marcus from Cornwall, Urians in North Wales. But not one of them can gain the support outside his own lands. And we could well be like the donkey who starved to death between two bales of fodder, not knowing which to eat first. We must have the Pendragon's son, young though he is."
Kevin said,
"I never heard that the Pendragon had a son.
Or has he recognized that son his wife bore to Cornwall, soon after they were married?"
"Uther must have been in unseemly haste to marry, if he couldn't even wait until she bore her child before taking her to his bed."
Vivian raised her hand.
"The young prince is the son of Uther," she said. "None may doubt it, nor will doubt it when they see him."
"Is it so?
Then Uther did well to hide him away," Kevin said, "for his son by another man's wife."
Vivian gestured him to silence.
"Igraine is my sister, and she is of the royal line of Avalon. This son of Uther and Igraine is the one whose coming was foretold, the king who was and will be. Already he has taken the antlers and been crowned over the tribes. What king in Britain, do you think, will accept some boy of 17 to be High King?"
Kevin asked sceptically.
"He could be brave as the fabled Cú Chulainn, and they would want a warrior of greater skill." "As for that, he has been schooled to war, and to the work of a king's son," Taliesin said, "though he knows not that his blood is royal. But I think the full moon just past gave him a sense of his destiny. Uther was honoured above any king before his time. This lad Arthur will set his state even higher. I have seen him on the throne. The question is not, will they accept him? But what can we do to set him about with all the majesty of the High King, so that all the warring kings will join hands against the Saxon instead of against one another? I have found the way to do that," Vivian said, "and at the new moon it shall be done. I have a sword for him, a sword out of legend, never before wielded by a living hero."
She paused a moment, then said slowly,
"And for that sword I shall exact from him a pledge. I shall swear him to be true to Avalon, despite whatever the Christians may do.
Then perhaps the tide will turn, and Avalon will return from the mists. And it is the monks and their dead god who will go into the shadows and the mists, while Avalon shines again in the light of the outer world.
An ambitious plan, said Kevin. But if, in truth, the High King of Britain were sworn to Avalon...
This has been planned since before he was born.
Taliesin said slowly.
The boy has been fostered a Christian. Will he take such an oath?
How real is the talk of gods to a boy, compared to a legendary sword with which to lead his people and the fame of great deeds?
Vivian shrugged.
Whatever may come of it, we have gone too far to stop now. We are all committed. In 3 days the moon will be new again, and at that auspicious time he shall have the sword.
There was little more to say. Morgaine sat quietly listening, both excited and appalled. She had been in Avalon too long, she thought, too long concealed among the priestesses with her mind on holy things and the secret wisdom. She had forgotten that there was a world outside. Somehow, it had never really come home to her that Uther Pendragon, her mother's husband, was High King of all Britain, and that her brother would be so some day.
Even,
she thought with a twist of that new cynicism, with the stain of doubt on his birth. Perhaps the rival kings would even welcome a candidate who had no loyalty to any of their parties and factions. A son of the Pendragon, handsome and modest, who could serve as a symbol round whom they all rallied. A candidate for High King, moreover, who had already been accepted by the tribes, and by the picked folk, and by Avalon. And then Morgaine flinched, remembering the part she had had in that. This brought her anger back, so that when Taliesin and Kevin rose to go, she remembered why she had wanted, 10 days ago, when it was fresh in her mind, to confront Vivian with her rage. Kevin's harp, in its ornamented leather bag, was difficult to carry, being so much larger than other harps. And when he was burdened with its weight, he looked awkward, one knee stiff and a foot dragging.
Ugly, she thought. An ugly, grotesque man.
But when he plays, who would think so? There is more to this man than any of us knows.
And then she remembered what Taliesin had said. She knew that she looked on the next Merlin of Britain, as Vivian had called her, next Lady of the Lake.
The pronouncement brought no elation, although if Vivian had said it before that journey which had changed her life, she would have been proud and excited. Now it seemed shadowed by the thing which had happened to her.
With my brother. My brother.
It didn't matter when we were priest and priestess, god and goddess joining under the power of ritual. But in the morning, when we wakened and were man and woman together, that was real. That was sin.
Vivian was standing at the door, watching them move away.
For a man with such injuries, he moves well. It is fortunate for the world that he survived them, and that he was not set as a beggar in the street, or to weaving rush mats in the market. Such skill as that one has shouldn't be hidden in obscurity, or even in the court of a king. A voice and hands like that belong to the gods.
He is gifted, certainly,
Morgaine said. But I wonder, is he wise? The Merlin of Britain must be not only learned and gifted, but wise as well, and virtuous.
I leave that to Taliesin, Vivian said. What shall be, must be. It is not mine to order.
And suddenly Morgaine's wrath overflowed.
Are you truly acknowledging that there is anything on the face of this earth which you feel is not yours to order, lady? I thought you believed that your will was the will of the goddess, and all of us puppets to serve you. You must not talk this way, my child, Vivian said, looking at her in astonishment. You can hardly mean to be so insolent to me. If Vivian had responded to her words with arrogance, it would have hardened Morgaine's anger into explosion. The gentleness baffled her. She said, "Vivian, why?" And felt shamefully that tears would rise again to choke her. Now Vivian's voice was cold. "Did I leave you for too long among the Christians, after all, with their talk of sin?" she said. "Think, child. You are of the royal line of Avalon. So too is he. Could I have given you to a commoner? Or could the High King to come be so given?" "And I believed you when you said... I believed it was the doing of the goddess." "Why, so it was," said Vivian gently, not understanding. "But even so, I couldn't give you to anyone unworthy of you, my Morgaine." Her voice was tender. "He was so young when you parted. I thought he would never have recognized you. I regret that you recognized him. But after all, you would have had to know sooner or later. And he need not know for a long time." Morgaine said, tightening her body against rage, "He knows already. He knows." And he was more horrified, I think, than I was. Vivian sighed. "Well, there is nothing we can do about that now," she said. "Done is done. And at this moment, the hope of Britain is more important than your feelings." Morgaine turned away and didn't wait to hear more. Chapter 17. The moon was dark in the sky. At this time, so the young priestesses were told in the House of Maidens, the goddess veils her face from mankind, taking counsel of the heavens themselves and the gods which lie behind the gods we know. Vivian, too, kept seclusion at moondark, her privacy guarded by two young priestesses. Most of that day she kept her bed, lying with closed eyes, and wondering if she was, after all, what Morgaine thought her, drunk with power, believing that all things were at her command to play with as she thought good. "What I have done," she thought, "I have done to save this land and its people from rapine and destruction, a reversion to barbarism, a sacking greater than Rome suffered from of the Goths." She longed to send for Morgaine, hungering for their old closeness. If indeed the girl came to hate her, it would be the heaviest price she would ever pay for anything she had done. Morgaine was the one human being she had ever wholly loved. "She is the daughter I owed the goddess. But done is done, and cannot be called back. The royal line of Avalon must not be contaminated by commoner blood." She thought of Morgaine with a sorrowful hope that one day the young woman would understand. But whether or no, Vivian knew she had done what she must, no more. She slept little that night, sliding off into chaotic dreams and visions, thinking of the sons she had distanced from her, or the world outside into which the young Arthur had ridden at Merlin's side. Had he come in time to his dying father? For 6 weeks, Uther Pendragon had lain ill in Caerleon, sinking, then rallying, but it seemed unlikely that he could live much longer. As the dawn neared, she rose and dressed herself,
so silently that neither of her attendant priestesses stirred.
Did Morgaine sleep in the House of Maidens, or did she too lie awake with heavy heart or weep?
Morgaine had never wept before her, until that day when Kevin's harp had stirred their hearts, and even then she had concealed her tears.
Done is done. I cannot spare her. But with all my heart I wish there had been some other way.
She went out silently into the garden behind her dwelling. Birds were waking. Apple blossoms, soft and sweet-scented, drifted from the trees which had given Avalon its name.
They will bear fruit in time to come, as what I do now will bear fruit in its own season. But I shall blossom nor bear fruit no more.
The burden of the years lay heavy on her mind.
I grow old. Even now at times the sight fails me, the sight I am given to guide this land.
Her own mother hadn't lived to be so old. The time would come, indeed was almost upon her, when she must lay down her burden and her holy office, giving over the real rulership of Avalon to the next lady standing behind her in the shadows as the wise woman, or the old death crone herself.
Morgaine is not yet ready. She still lives by the world's time, and she can still tremble and weep for what cannot be avoided.
Her mind ran over the roster of priestesses, the young and the old, in Avalon. There was none to whom she could entrust the rulership of this land.
Morgaine would some day grow to that stature, but not yet. Raven might have had that strength, but Raven had given her voice to the gods. Raven was for the divine madness of the worlds beyond, not for the sober counsel and judgment of this one.
What would come to Britain if she should die before Morgaine was grown to her full powers? Overhead the sky was still dark, although in the east the mist was lightening with the dawn. As she watched, the light grew. The red clouds formed slowly, twisting into the shape of a red dragon coiling along the whole horizon. Then a great shooting star flamed along the sky, paling the form of the red dragon. Its brilliance blinded Vivian for a moment, and when she could see again, the red dragon was gone, and the shifting clouds were white with the rising sun. Vivian felt shivers raking her spine. A portent like this wasn't seen twice in a lifetime. The whole of Britain must be alive with it.
So passes Uther, she thought. Farewell to the dragon who has spread his wings over our coast. Now will the Saxons be loosed upon us.
She sighed, and then, without warning, there was a ripple in the air, and a man stood before her in the garden. She trembled, not with the fear which a house-bred woman might feel of an intruder.
Vivian had no fear of any man living,
but because it had been long since she had experienced a true sending of this kind. A vision which intruded on her, unsummoned, must be of great power.
Power like the shooting star, a portent such as has not been seen in my lifetime.
For a moment she didn't recognize the man who stood before her. Wasting illness had greyed the fair hair, shrunk the broad shoulders, and stooped the spine. The skin was yellowed, and the eyes sunken with pain. Even thus, Uther Pendragon seemed, as always, larger than most men, and though there was little sound in the enclosed garden, so that she heard the twittering birds through his voice, yes, and saw the blossoming trees through his body. It seemed that he spoke, as always, to her, harshly, without warmth.
So, Vivian, we meet for the last time. There is a bond between us, not one I would have desired. We have not been friends, sister-in-law. But I trust to your vision, for what you spoke came always true. And you are the only one to make it sure that the next High King of Britain can take what is rightfully his. Now she saw that across his breast was the mark of a great wound. How had it come about that Uther Pendragon, lying sick in Caerleon, had died of a wound and not of his long illness?
I died as a warrior would die. The treaty troops broke their faith again, and my armies couldn't stand against them until I had myself carried to show myself on the field. Then they rallied, but Ash, the Saxons' chief, I will not grant that wild savage the name of king, broke through and slew three of my guard, and I killed him before his bodyguard could kill me. But we won that battle. The next battle will be for my son, if he comes to the throne.
Vivian heard herself say aloud through the silence,
Arthur is king through the old royal line of Avalon. He needs no Pendragon blood to take his rightful place as High King.
But this, which would have made the living Uther burst out in wrath, only called forth the wry smile, and for the last time she seemed to hear his voice.
I doubt not it would take more than even your magic, sister-in-law, to make the lesser kings of Britain see that. You may think scorn of the Pendragon's blood, but it is upon that Merlin must call to put Arthur on my throne.
And then, before her eyes, the form of Uther Pendragon faded. And before her stood another man whom the living Vivian had seen only in dreams. And in a searing moment Vivian knew why no man had ever been more to her than duty, or a path to power, or a knight's pleasure. For a moment she stood in a land drowned before the ringstones on the Tor were raised, and about her arms she wore twining gold serpents. The faded crescent burned like a great horned moon between her brows, and she knew him with a knowledge that went beyond time or space. She cried aloud with a great mourning cry for all that she had never known in this life, and the agony of a bereavement unguessed till this moment. Then the garden was empty, and the birds twittered mindlessly in the damp silence of the mists that concealed the rising sun. And far away, in Caerleon, Igraine, knowing herself widowed, cries out for her love. It is hers to mourn him now. Vivian caught for support against the dew-drenched bark of the great tree, and leaned against it, wrung with unexpected sorrow. He had never known her. He had disliked her, had never trusted her until the very moment of his death, when the mortal disguise of one lifetime fell away. Goddess, be merciful. A lifetime gone, and I never knew him. Gone, gone again. And will I know him again when we meet, or will we walk blinded again, passing each other by as strangers? But there was no answer, only silence. And Vivian couldn't even weep.
Igraine will weep for him. I cannot.
Quickly she collected herself. This was no time to stand and mourn for a love like a dream within a dream. Time began to move for her again, and she looked back on the vision with a faint dismay. She could find no grief in her now for the dead man, nor anything except exasperation. She might have known that he would manage to die at the most inconvenient time possible, before he had time to proclaim his son to the rival kinglets, all striving for the crown of the High King. Why had he not stayed in Caerleon? Why had he given in to the pride which had led him to show himself one more time in battle? Had he even seen his son? Had the Merlin arrived in time? The sending had gone beyond recall. There was no way to summon it back and ask mundane questions. Uther had indeed come to her at the moment of his death. It was just as well Ygraine would never know that. But he was gone. Vivian glanced skyward. There was no sign yet of the crescent moon in the sky. Perhaps she still might see something in her mirror. Should she call Raven? No, there was no time for that, and Raven might not consent to break her silence for a vision of affairs in the world outside. Morgaine! She shrank from meeting Morgaine's eyes. Will she live all her life as I have done, with a heart dead inside her body? She drew a long, shuddering breath and turned to leave the garden. It was still very damp and cold. The sunrise was still hidden in mist. There was none to see as she walked swiftly up the secret way toward the holy well, where she bent to drink, flinging her hair back, cupping her hands to the water. Then she went to the mirror pool. For so many years she had served the shrine here that she had come to take for granted her power of vision. But now, unlike herself, she prayed, "Goddess, do not take the power from me, not yet, not for a little while. Mother, you know I do not ask it for myself, only that this land may be safe until I can place it into the hands which I have prepared to safeguard it." For a moment she saw only the ripples across the pool's water, and clenched her hands as if she could force vision. Then slowly images began to form. She saw the Merlin going up and down the length of the land on his hidden ways, now as a druid and bard, as befitted the messenger of the gods, now as an old beggar or peddler, or as a simple harper. The face began to shift and change, and she saw Kevin the bard, now in the white robes of the messenger of Avalon, now in a nobleman's dress, confronting the Christian priests. And there was a shadow behind his head. He was circled in shadows, the shadow of the oak grove, the shadow of the cross. She saw him with the sacred cup of the druid regalia. She saw the young Arthur, his brow still stained with the blood of the stag he had fought and slain, and Morgaine laughing, crowned with flowers, her face marked with blood. She didn't want to see it, and willed ferociously to turn her eyes away, but dared not break the flow of the visions. She saw a Roman villa, and Arthur standing between two boys. One was her own Lancelot, her younger son. She supposed the older was Arthur's foster brother, Caius, the son of Ectorius. She saw Morgause surrounded by her sons. One by one they knelt at Arthur's feet. Then she saw the Avalon barge draped in black like a pall, and Morgaine in the prow. Only Morgaine was older. Older and weeping. Impatiently Vivian passed her hand over the surface of the water. This was no time to stand here seeking guidance from visions which seemed to bear no meaning for the moment. She walked quickly down the hill toward her dwelling and summoned her attendant priestesses. "Dress me," she said curtly, "and send for the Merlin. He must ride for Caerleon, and bring the young Arthur to me here before the moon is more than a day old in the sky. There is no time to waste." Chapter 18. But Arthur didn't come with the new moon to Avalon. Morgaine, in the House of Maidens, saw the new moon born,
but she didn't break the moon-dark fast. She felt faint, and knew that if she ate, she would only be sick. Well, perhaps it was to be expected. She sometimes felt this way when her monthly courses were about to begin. Later she would feel better. And later in the day she did feel better, and drank a little milk, and ate some bread. And that afternoon Vivian sent for her.
"Uther lies dead in Carleon," she said. "If you feel you must go to your mother."
For a short time Morgaine considered that, but at last she shook her head. "I had no love for Uther," she said,
"and Igraine knows it well.
The goddess grant that some of her priestly counsellors may comfort her better than I could." Vivian sighed. She looked tired and worn, and Morgaine wondered if she too felt sick with the aftermath of the stressful time of the moon's darkening. Vivian said,
"Sorrow that I must say it, but I fear you are right. I would have spared you to her, if need be. There would be time for you to return to Avalon before—"
She broke off and then said,
"You know that Uther, in his lifetime, kept the Saxons at bay, though with constant battle. We have not had more than a few moons of peace at any time. Now I fear it will be worse. They may come even to the doors of Avalon."
"Morgaine, you are full priestess. You have seen the sacred weapons." Morgaine replied with a sign, and Vivian nodded and said,
"A day may come when that sword must be lifted in defence of Avalon, and of all Britain, too."
Morgaine thought, "Why say this to me? I am priestess, not warrior. I cannot take the sword in defence of Avalon."
"You remember the sword?"
Barefoot, cold, tracing the circle with the weight of the sword in her hand, hearing Raven, the silent, cry aloud in terror.
"I remember."
"Then I have a task for you," Vivian said. "When that sword is carried into battle, it must be circled with all the magic we have. You are to fashion a scabbard for the sword, Morgaine, and set into it every spell you know, that he who bears it into battle shall lose no blood. Can you do that?"
"I had forgotten," Morgaine thought, "that there might be a task for a priestess as well as a warrior." And with her trick of following a thought, Vivian said,
"So you too shall have a part in the battle to defend our country."
"So be it," Morgaine said, wondering why Vivian, who was the great priestess of Avalon, didn't take this task for herself. The older woman gave her no answer, but said,
"For this you must work with the sword before you. Come, and Raven shall serve you within the silence of magic."
Although she tried to remember that she was only a vessel of power and not the power itself, that the power itself came from the goddess, Morgaine was young enough to feel exalted when she was conducted in silence to the secret place where work like this must be done, and surrounded by the priestesses who were to anticipate her every need, so that she might not break the silence which would build the necessary power for the setting of spells. The sword was laid on a linen cloth before her. Beside it, the low-brimmed chalice, fashioned of silver with gold beading round the edge. It was filled with water from the holy well. Not for drinking, food and water were set aside for her, but that she might look into it and see within it such things as were needful for the work she must do. On the first day she cut, using the sword itself, an undersheath of thin doeskin. It was the first time she had had fine tools to work with, and she took pleasure in the special iron needle she had been given to stitch the sheath together. She took a pride which she knew was childish, in that when she pricked her finger once or twice, she didn't utter even a momentary cry.
She couldn't restrain a little caught breath of pure pleasure when she was shown the priceless piece of deepest crimson velvet, dyed with colours which, she had been once told, cost more money for an ounce than would buy a villa and hire men to work the land on it for a year. This would cover the doeskin, and on it she must work in the golden and silken threads provided, the magical spells and their symbols. Fashioning the shapes of doeskin sheath and velvet to cover it, she spent the first day, and before she slept, deep in the meditation of what she must do, almost in trance, she cut her arm a little and smeared the doeskin with her blood. "Goddess, great raven, blood has been shed upon this scabbard, so that none need be spilt upon it when it is carried into battle." She slept fitfully, dreaming that she sat on a high hill overlooking all of Britain and stitched spells, weaving them like visible light into the fabric of the earth itself. Below her the king stag was running, and a man came striding up the hill to her and took the sword from her hand. She woke with a start, thinking, "Arthur. It is Arthur who will bear the sword. He is the son of Pendragon." And as she lay in the darkness, she thought that was why Vivian had given it to her, to make the magical scabbard for the sword he should bear in symbol of all his people. It was Arthur who had shed the blood of her virginity, and it was she, also of the sacred line of Avalon, who must fashion the spell scabbard of his safety, guarding the royal blood. All that day, in silence, she worked, gazing into the chalice, letting the images rise, now and then stopping to wait for inspiration in the meditative flow. She worked the horned moon, so that the goddess should always watch over the sword and guard the sacred blood of Avalon. She was so wrapped in the magical silence that every object on which her eyes gazed, every movement of her consecrated hands, became power for the spell. It seemed at times as if visible light followed her fingers as she followed the horned moon with the full moon, and then with the dark moon, for all things must follow in season. Then, because she knew that a high king in Britain must rule in a Christian land, and because, when first the followers of the Christ had come to Britain, they had come here to the Druids, she worked in the symbol of Christian and Druid in friendship, the cross within the three-winged circle. She worked into the crimson velvet the signs of the magical elements of earth and air and water and fire, and then figured the low-handled cup before her in which visions moved and entwined, coming in and out of darkness. Wand and earth platter, serpent of healing and wings of wisdom, and the flaming sword of power. There were times when it seemed that needle and thread moved through her own flesh or through the flesh of the land, piercing earth and sky and her own blood and body. Sign upon sign, and symbol upon symbol, each marked with her blood and with the water of the holy well. 3 days in all she worked, sleeping little, eating only a few bites of dried fruit, drinking only the water of the well. There were times when, from a great distance within her own mind, she seemed to look out on her fingers, working without any conscious choice. The spells wove themselves. Blood and bone of the land, blood of her maidenhood, strength of the king stag who had died and shed his blood so that the champion might not die. By sunset of the third day, it was finished. Every inch of the scabbard covered with twining symbols, some of which she didn't even recognize. Surely they had come directly from the hand of the goddess through her hands. She lifted it, slid the sword into it, weighted it in her hands, then said aloud, breaking the ritual silence, "It is done." Now that the long tension was broken, she was aware that she was exhausted, shaken and sick.
Ritual and prolonged use of the site could do this. It had, no doubt, interrupted her courses, too, for they usually came on at moondark. This was said to be lucky, for the priestesses went apart to shield their power at this time, and it was the same as the ritual seclusion of the dark moon, when the goddess herself secluded herself to safeguard the source of power. Vivian came and took the scabbard. She couldn't suppress a little cry of astonishment as she looked upon it, and indeed it seemed even to Morgain, who knew her own hands had fashioned it, to be a thing surpassing human work, pregnant with magic. Vivian touched it only briefly before wrapping it in a long white silken cloth. "You have done well," she said, and Morgain thought, her mind spinning, "How is it that she thinks she can judge me? I, too, am a priestess. I have gone beyond her teaching." And was shocked at her own thought. Vivian touched her cheek gently. "Go and sleep, my dearest. You have wearied yourself in this great work." Morgain slept deeply and long, without dreams. But after midnight, suddenly, she woke to the sudden wild clamour of alarm bells. Alarm bells, church bells, a terror out of childhood. "The Saxons are upon us. Get up and arm yourselves." It seemed that she woke out of a start, and she wasn't in the house of maidens, but in a church. And on the altar stone of the church lay a set of weapons, and on a trestle nearby lay a man in armour, covered with a pall. Above her the warning was still pealing and clamouring, fit to wake the dead. No, for the dead knight did not stir, and with a sudden prayer for forgiveness she snatched up the sword, and woke fully this time to light in her room and quiet. Not even the church bells from the other island penetrated the quiet of her stone-floored chamber. She had dreamed the bells, the dead knight, and the chapel with burning tapers, the arms on the altar, the sword, all of it. How did I come to see that? The sight never comes upon me undesired. Was it just a dream, then? Later that day she was summoned. With her conscious mind she remembered some of the visions which had floated half-seen through her mind as she wrought the scabbard with the sword before her. Fallen to earth in a falling star, a clap of thunder, a great burst of light, dragged still smoking to be forged by the little dark smiths who had dwelled on the chalk before the ringstones were raised. Powerful, a weapon for a king, broken and reforged this time into the long leaf-shaped blade, tooled and annealed in blood and fire, hardened. A sword three times forged, never ripped out of the earth's womb, and thus twice holy. She had been told the name of the sword, Excalibur, which meant cut steel. Swords of meteorite iron were rare and precious. This one might well be the price of a kingdom. Vivian bade her cover herself with her veil and come. As they moved slowly down the hillside, she saw the tall figure of Taliesin the Merlin, Kevin the Bard at his side, moving with his hesitant, grotesque walk. He seemed more than ever clumsy and ugly, as out of place as a lump of tallow clinging to the edge of a fine-wrought silver candlestick. And at their side, Morgain froze, recognizing that slender, muscular body, that shining silver-gilt hair. Arthur. But of course she had known the sword was for him. What was more natural than he should come here to receive it? "He is a warrior, a king, the little brother I held upon my lap." It seemed unreal to her. But through that Arthur, and the solemn-faced boy who walked now between the two druids, she saw some trace of the youth who had taken upon himself the antlers of the horned god, Quiet and grave as he was, she saw the swing of the antlers, the deadly, desperate fight, and how he had come to her bloodied with the stag's blood. No child, but a man.